and her condition was stable, and we'd left her with Johann's body armor and a pistol. Besides Alexandra, we had another long pole in the tent. We didn't have enough transportation to get everyone off the base. Aaron had said there were five of them, with one possibly non-ambulatory. And all we had were our stolen SUVs. I decided to split the force in two, a prison assault force and a transportation location force. The prison assault would be Knuckles, Jennifer, Shoshana, Aaron, and me. The vehicle scavenger hunt would be Johann, Brett, and Veep. Johann knew the base better than any of us. Brett could blend in when they stole whatever they found, and Veep was just good with a gun. The rest of us would attempt the prison breakout, ostensibly the harder of the missions, but I wasn't betting on it. My earpiece came alive, and I heard, "In position, stand by." Then, "Targets down, targets down." We began driving down the road, and I saw the drop bar rise. We stopped for barely a second, letting them into our vehicles, and were rolling through the gate, back into the darkness. I surveyed 360 degrees trying to identify a response, my finger tapping the trigger guard of my Glock, the adrenaline starting to rise. Amazingly, I saw nothing. We were in. Aaron was behind the wheel of our SUV, since he was the only one who knew where the prison was located, Brett driving the one behind us. We rolled on the blacktop as fast as we dared without our lights, driving under nods. Luckily, the base itself had very little outdoor lighting, with most of the weak illumination provided by light bulbs attached to buildings. So you'd have to be right next to us to see us pass by. I felt Aaron slow down, then stop, and heard, "Pike, problem." Ahead of us, at the first intersection on the gate road, I saw a checkpoint. Three men were standing, next to a 55-gallon drum with a fire in it, one of them yelling and waving his arms in the air. Uh-oh. Aaron said, "The guy shouting is Lurch, the head asshole at the prison. The other two must be guards he's brought out in an attempt to catch me escaping." We watched for a second, then Lurch stormed over to a Land Rover and drove off, moving deeper into the base. Aaron said, "Blow through it?" I glanced left and right, looking for a way to avoid the checkpoint. There was none, only grass fields and woods. I said, "No. That'll just bring a chase. With your plan, we're going to need time, stealth. We won't get that with a compromise right off the bat. Pull up to it." I turned around and said, "Knuckles, you got the guy on the left. I'll take the right." We rolled up to the intersection, and I saw a U-shaped cinder block building about 150 meters down a dirt road, a canvas-covered 2.5-ton truck out front, just like the ones that had shown up in Morija. Probably the same one we had shot at an hour ago. I called, "Blood, Blood, take a look to the left." He said, "I see it." "We've got the checkpoint, stand by. The bodies are staying in the street, so the clock will be ticking." Aaron pulled up to the barrel on the side of the road, the fire providing flickering illumination. All three of us rolled down our windows. I held my suppressed ZevTech down against the door, waiting for the guard on my side to approach. Both were clearly confused, seeing white men in an SUV on their base at 2 in the morning. The one on Aaron's side approached first and began asking questions, which, of course, we couldn't answer. My target hung back, refusing to approach. "Come on, dipshit. Come up to the window." The tension mounted, until finally, the guard on the driver's side became suspicious. He backed up at Aaron's bullshit explanation and raised his rifle. Knuckles shot him in the head, the suppressor giving off a muted spit. The round snapped him backward like he had a string attached to his skull. I threw open my door, rolled out, and took aim, expecting to be receiving fire from the second guard. Inexplicably, instead of raising his weapon, my guy took off running in a panic. I lined up the holosight and broke the trigger to the rear twice, the ZevTech tracking effortlessly. He tumbled forward, rolling lifelessly on the ground. I leapt back in and said, "Go, go." I looked behind me and saw Brett take the intersection toward the lorry, pulling into the shadows of the trees. I said, "How much farther?" Aaron pointed at a large one-story building set back into the woods about 100 meters away. "That's it. I'll park across the other side in the brush, and we'll walk in. My window is on the back side to the south. Your position is backside north, on the other end. Let me work it. But if I need you, clear the building all the way to me. I said, hope that won't be necessary. We exited, softly closing the doors, then approached the building using the cover of the brush, avoiding the main front entrance and circling around to the back. Aaron led us down the cinder blocks for about 30 feet, then stopped, pointing at a hole above him. I nodded, and we left him and Shoshana, continuing on until we located a wooden door at the northern end. I established security, putting Jennifer on the corner looking out toward the main entrance, and waited. 20 minutes later, I got the call that Aaron had made contact with Thomas, and I had Knuckles place his charge, leaving Jennifer on the corner pulling security. So far, so good. I called Brett saying, we've got contact, starting extraction. What's your status?
74. Studying the U-shaped building with his nods, Brett saw what might have been movement on the porch. He turned his attention to the truck parked off to the side and saw a soldier in the driver's seat. He whispered, Veep, what do you have? Positioned in the wood line on the other side of the road, Veep had a different view. I have a man in the passenger seat and two on the porch. There's a light in one room on the east side, so I'm assuming someone's in there as well. Pike came through. We've got contact. Starting extraction. What's your status? This is Blood. Conducting recce now. It's looking promising, but I'm not committing just yet. Roger all. Don't get compromised. That's a priority. Understood. Break, break. Veep, keep your eye on the porch. Tell me if anyone else shows up. Brett touched Johann's sleeve and said, there's a guy in the driver's seat and one in the passenger seat, and we have to secure that building before we steal it. The vehicle was an obstacle to assaulting the building, something that had to be passed in order to access a breach point. But luckily, it was parked far enough away that, if they did it correctly, they could eliminate the two men inside the truck without alerting anyone else. Johann nodded and said, what about the bed of the truck? Brett said, I don't know. I don't think anyone would be in the back if they're parked at a building. But then again, I wouldn't expect two guys to be up front. Johann said, let me see your nods. Brett passed them to him, and he focused on the truck, searching for something specific. He found it and handed them back. That's the same truck used in the field. It's full of bullet holes. There were about 10 or 12 guys in that fight, and we took out at least 6 of them, so that leaves a max of 6, maybe less. What if this is a barracks? There could be 30 guys inside, and I don't want to find that out the hard way. It's not. It's the headquarters for the Military Intelligence Battalion that supports the SF Regiment. I've had the pleasure of being interrogated inside it. The left side of the wing is nothing but classrooms. The right, where the light is on, is the commander's office. Johann slung his weapon onto his back and withdrew a fixed-blade fighting knife. He said, cover me, and I'll check out the truck's bed. If it's clean, I'll take the guy on the passenger's side. You take the driver's side. Good? Brett nodded, then said, shoot me 2 flashes if it's clean. 3 if it's dirty. They didn't have enough equipment to outfit Johann with task force communications, so they were forced to improvise. Brett got on the net and said, Veep, Johann's moving to the truck. Keep your targets on the porch. If they show hostile intent, drop them. Roger. Brett tapped Johann on the shoulder and handed him the set of nods. Johann lay down, then crawled on his belly to the rear of the truck. He rose into a crouch, listening. When he was satisfied, he slowly peeled a corner of the canvas away and used the night vision on the inside. He slid back down and stowed the nods, and Brett saw 2 flashes. Brett withdrew his own fighting knife and Lowe crawled to the rear of the truck. He showed the blade to Johann and leaned into his ear, whispering, "You initiate," then drew a finger across his throat. Johann nodded and rolled to the passenger side. Brett went left, sliding down the truck bed. He reached the driver's door and glanced up. He could see the head of his target against the window, asleep. He gently put his palm on the handle, wrapping his fingers around the metal, waiting on Johann. He heard the far door open, the hinges groaning in the night, and yanked down on his handle. The door refused to open. In one painful, panicked microsecond, he realized the man had fallen asleep on the latch, locking the door. He heard a brief struggle on the far side and saw his man waking up. He leapt onto the running board and shattered the window with his elbow, catching the man's head at the same time. He grabbed the target by his hair and yanked him halfway out, stuck the blade under his neck, and sliced both carotid arteries, a great gout of blood spilling onto the door of the truck. He dropped to the ground, unslung his weapon, and took a knee at the front tire, searching for threats. He saw the two men on the porch, both startled at the noise. One took a single step off the porch, and his head snapped back. He collapsed in a heap, rolling into the courtyard. The other one raised his weapon, and Brett broke the trigger, throwing him against a wall. Everything grew quiet. Johann appeared by his side, and they both waited to see if they were compromised, expecting a horde to come barreling out of the darkness. Johann said, "What the hell happened?" Fucker had the door locked. They heard a shout from the lighted room. A question spoken in the Sesotho language floated across the courtyard, followed by a snort. Johann let out a soft laugh. Brett whispered, "What?" "I know who that is. I'm going to enjoy this." On the net, Brett said, "Veep, what do you have?"
"Nothing. I've got nothing. It's quiet.
Provide overwatch on our side. We're assaulting the room on your side." He hated the plan, but it was a little difficult to dominate the building with overwhelming force when they only had a three-man assault team. He had a choice: start clearing from one end and moving to the other, or focus directly on the room where they knew a threat existed. He chose the latter. Brett took aim at the corner of the building, settling his red dot on the lone bulb, putting out illumination, and fired. It shattered, plunging the courtyard into darkness. He said, "Let's go," and sprinted down the road. He crossed the courtyard, running to the door adjacent to the illuminated window, leaving the entire opposite side wide open to his back. He prayed Johann was right, because if it was a barracks, they were dead. He stacked on the door, waited for Johann to touch his shoulder, then kicked it in. Two men leapt to their feet, neither one armed. One was a short, bald-headed man who took one look at Johann and began stuttering incoherently. The other sprinted toward an AK leaning against the wall. Johann's rifle spit two suppressed rounds, knocking the man to the floor. Brett cleared the rest of the room, then rotated to the door, saying, "Veep, Veep, what do you have?"
"Nothing. All's quiet."
To the bald-headed man, Johann said, "Get on your knees." The man did as he was told, and Johann said, "Well, frog, looks like I get to ask the questions this time." Brett said, "You weren't kidding? You know this guy?" "He did a little interrogation of me earlier. He thought I was U.S. Special Forces out to do something bad in his country. He was only half right." Johann walked to the man and got in his face, then theatrically pulled his fighting knife free. He said, "How many men are in this building?"
"Four. Only four."
And then he snorted. causing Johann to chuckle. Brett said, "That's it? Four plus you two?" The man nodded frantically, saying, "The rest are dead in the field." Brett clicked on the net and said, "Veep, veep, bring it in. Break, break. Pike, this is Blood. We have your exfil platform. What's the status?" 75. Aaron heard the call and answered for Pike. "I've got three out, two more, and we can exfil. 10 more minutes, max." Aaron grabbed the jacket of the last of Thomas's inner circle and hoisted the man through the ragged hole in the wall while Thomas pushed from the other side. He slid out, and Aaron lowered him to the ground. Shoshana immediately went to work on his leg shackles, using the key Aaron had given her. That left only Thomas inside, and Aaron knew he would need some help. With no other members of his circle inside the prison to hoist him, Thomas would have trouble reaching the hole. Aaron said, "Shoshana, one more time, please." She squatted down, placing her back against the wall, and holding her hands at shoulder height, palms up. He put his feet on them and stood, getting level with the hole he'd made. It had taken more time than he had wanted to extract the weakened man through the window, and it had been a miracle that nobody in the prison had challenged their dwindling numbers. They had been helped by the darkness, as the lone bulb usually used to illuminate the cell had remained off, leaving the inside as black as a cave. Coupled with that, the uniformed tribe seemed content to pace at the entrance, shouting questions at the guard down the hallway, more concerned with what was occurring outside the prison than with the rear of their cell. Aaron rose up on Shoshana's hands, eliciting a soft grunt. He whispered, "Thomas, let's go." Thomas's face appeared in the window, and Jennifer came on the net. "All elements, this is Coco. Vehicle just approached the prison's main entrance. Two men exiting. One of them is shouting." Aaron thought, "Lurch." He said, "Thomas, come on, quickly." Aaron heard a commotion from inside the cell, the uniformed tribe excited about something. Thomas stood on the bucket, and Aaron heard Lurch coming down the hallway, screaming in a rage loud enough for the sound to penetrate outside the hole. He clicked onto the net and said, "Pike, Pike, execute, execute, execute." Aaron grabbed Thomas's arm, saying, "Come on, climb." Aaron heard the dull thump of Pike's explosive breech on the far side of the building, and the room blazed into light from the single bulb. Thomas jerked his arm free, giving Aaron a grim smile, his perfect teeth gleaming in the tepid light. Thomas said, "Go. Get them out of here. I will delay the captain." "No, you dumbass. Come on." Thomas stepped off the bucket and disappeared. Lurch entered the cell and began raving like a lunatic. Aaron grabbed the sides of the hole and pulled himself back into the hell he'd worked so hard to escape. He heard Shoshana shout, "No!" And then he hit the ground behind the blanket. He withdrew his pistol, took a breath, and tore the blanket aside. Thomas was on his knees, his hands behind his head, with Lurch facing him head-on and a prison guard off to each side, each holding an AK-47 aimed at him. Instinct and training took over, Aaron's body functioning with the precision of a computer, the focal point being the muzzle of his barrel. He fired a double tap, hitting the guard on the left in the head, then rotated on his knee to the one on the right, breaking the trigger two more times before the first body had even collapsed, his aim impeccable. The room erupted into shouting, the uniformed prisoners running back and forth at the front of the cell. Lurch jerked Thomas to his feet, using his body as a shield. He brandished a small Makarov pistol and placed it at the base of Thomas's skull. Spittle flying from his mouth, he shouted,
You? How?
Aaron said, You let him go, and you live. To the other prisoners, Lurch said,
Attack him! He's only one man. He can't kill you all. When he's dead, I'll let all of you go free.
Seven of the prisoners stood. Aaron kept his weapon on Lurch, afraid to take his eyes off the Makarov. The prisoners advanced forward, and the lead man's head exploded, flinging him back. Aaron felt movement behind him, and Shoshana appeared, holding her pistol as steady as a rail. The others stopped in their tracks, looking at Lurch. He screamed again,
Attack them! They can't get you all!
Shoshana said, First one to take a step forward will die. I promise. They shuffled back and forth, but refused to advance. Lurch began backing up to the door, dragging Thomas with him. He took aim at one of the prisoners and shot him in the chest, screaming,
Attack them!
The prisoners recoiled, each trying to use another as a shield. An AK-47 erupted in the hallway outside the cell, and Lurch whirled. Aaron saw Knuckles enter. So close to Lurch, he was prevented from bringing his weapon to bear. Knuckles hammered Lurch across the bridge of his nose with his suppressor, dropped his weapon on its sling, trapped Lurch's gun hand, and swept his feet out from under him. Before he'd even hit the ground, Pike and Jennifer entered, flowing into the room and looking for threats like water searching for low ground. They took up points of domination, and Knuckles punched Lurch in the temple twice, knocking the fight out of him. Seeing the area was clear, Pike lowered his weapon, saying, Jennifer, secure the hallway. Knuckles, flex tie that shithead. Aaron, call Brett for exfil. He turned to the man they'd just saved and said,
Thomas Naboni, I presume.
Thomas said, Yes, then watched Shoshana shadow Aaron, refusing to move more than a foot away from him, pacing wherever he went, like she was afraid of losing him. Thomas made the connection and calmly walked to her, as if the preceding action had been a normal occurrence in his everyday life. To the room, Aaron said, Trucks 1 minute out. Prepare for exfil. Thomas ignored the words, as if he had all the time in the world. He took Shoshana's hand and kissed it, saying,
Shoshana, I presume.
She nodded, and he said,
Aaron promised you'd be coming. He thinks quite highly of you. I must admit, I didn't have the same faith.
She smiled, the compliment causing her to glance shyly at Aaron. Something so out of character it made Pike laugh. Shoshana's eyes slit, and Pike couldn't resist a jab.
Thomas, don't get too close. She's crazy, and it rubs off.
Shoshana scowled, her essence bubbling back to the surface, but before she could retort, Knuckles finished flex-tying Lurch, saying,
What about this asshole?
Aaron said, I have an idea. Lurch watched him approach, his eyes so wide the whites glowed against his charcoal skin. Aaron squatted down, studying him like a child would a bug crawling on a stick. He said, I think we just leave him here. Aaron looked over at the uniformed prisoners and said, You men mind watching him until help arrives? Can you keep him safe? Since he cared so much for your welfare? One of the prisoners glanced down at the man Lurch had killed, then in halting English said,
Yes, please. We would like that very much.
Jennifer poked her head in from the hallway and said, Vehicles here. Pike said, Let's go. We still need to get off the base. Thomas said,
What's the next step? Where are you taking us?
Well, there's a little bit of payback for helping you.
Thomas grew wary, glancing at Aaron and saying,
Payback? How? What do you want?
I want you to run this country.
Thomas's mouth fell open, and Shoshana pushed him forward, the team taking up security positions as they moved, protecting him. Aaron brought up the rear, keeping his eyes on the prisoners who remained behind. The last thing he saw was Lurch in the center of them, the prisoners circling like a pack of dogs, barking and spitting. One kicked him in the stomach, and the floodgate of rage opened. Lurch lost in the flurry of blows.
76. Sitting in the SUV with Aaron, Knuckles, and Thomas, I watched Johann through the window, talking into his radio, the clouds reflecting the feeble light of false dawn. He waved his arms in the air as he spoke, but it was impossible to tell if he was receiving bad news or just coordinating. I hoped it was the latter, because we'd used up all our luck in the past 24 hours. If we had more work to do, it would be asking for Murphy to kick us in the balls. Getting off the base had proven much easier than getting on, probably because we'd killed just about anyone of rank who was still available, and we'd driven straight back to where we'd stashed Alexandra. She was in significant pain, and Brett, our designated team medic, had set about tending to her wound. He'd pronounced it satisfactory, but he was worried about any future delays and wanted to get her to a hospital. I echoed that sentiment, of course, but I wasn't sure how soon it would occur. Jennifer and Shoshana were with her in the abandoned hut, keeping her spirits up, while the rest of us talked to Thomas. We'd just given him a complete briefing on what was occurring in the country of Lesotho, leaving out any mention of nuclear triggers and top-secret organizations, and he was stunned. Not so much that it was happening. Nothing about the corruption of the current government could shock him after what it had done to him and his friends, but that we actually had the ability to alter the outcome. He said,
"I'm not sure I'm the man you seek. I was running for a seat in Parliament just to force the conversation. That was all. I didn't expect to win, and certainly didn't expect to become as popular as I was. The fact remains, I have no experience in government."
Aaron said,
"You want to feed the future of your country to that shithead, Makalo Lanatha. He was what you were fighting for?" "No, of course not. It's just that maybe we should look for someone else. Someone with experience."
I said, "Are you kidding? What do you want to do, check on Craigslist in the Help Wanted section? Is there another jail around here with political prisoners you want to hit?" Thomas went from me to Aaron, his mouth opening and closing, the enormity of what we were asking settling in. Knuckles said,
"Thomas, don't take this the wrong way, because I would have come for you regardless. But don't let the risks we took for your men mean nothing. You ran into Aaron for a reason. Seize it. Your country needs you."
Thomas chewed his thumb and stared out the window. He turned and said,
"Can I bring my own team with me? The ones who are in prison?"
I laughed and said, "You're the damn prime minister. It's your call."
"How will we do this? If the military is the power behind this coup, how will we get them to back me? General Mosibo was going to kill me tonight. What's to prevent him from doing the same tomorrow?"
"The military won't back you, true, but that's no longer a concern. They won't back anyone now, because General Mosibo's dead."
"What?"
Aaron said,
"I killed him. He's no longer in the equation. You have the police on your side, and that may be enough." "Then why is the military doing this?"
"They don't know he's dead, and we'll use that to our advantage." He seemed bewildered. He said,
"May I think a moment? Talk to my friends."
I opened the door, saying, "Sure, but don't waste time. That's a commodity we do not have." He left, and Johann returned, saying,
"It's official. All targets are down, and they're starting to consolidate. Only two hiccups. One, the television station is broadcasting, but so far, it's just random gunfire stories. Nothing firm. Two, those idiots killed the Prime Minister. He was supposed to be taken for a big show trial, but he got caught in the crossfire."
I asked, "How does that affect the coup?"
"It actually helps. He wouldn't stand a chance against Lanatha once he was arrested, but he'd clean Thomas's clock. He had too many allies. He'd be out of prison in hours."
"Good. What's the status on the aircraft?"
"It's circling just outside the Lesotho airspace, waiting on my call."
"What's up with Thomas?
He's overwhelmed, and rightfully so. I'm worried about putting him in place and somebody taking him out immediately. If he can't get support from some bloc in the Lesotho government, he needs immediate international support.
What happened with your call to Haya?
Earlier, I sent a sit rep to Blaine, detailing what was happening. He was a little shocked at how fast things had progressed, but was on board with the wait-for-the-coup-to-finish plan for capturing Colonel Armstrong, and by extension, Tyler Malloy. I'd asked him to have the task force weigh in, getting the Oversight Council to immediately support Thomas Noboni's legitimacy, which meant leveraging the State Department to do the same. He'd said he would try, but that was about it. I said, my hire is going to try to work it, but there are so many layers between me and the power brokers that I don't have a whole lot of faith. I don't want to rescue Thomas only to see him a week later swinging from a lamppost on CNN. We need a reaction right now, not 3 days from now. Johann said, I have an idea about that. You do? What, you think you can get South Africa to back him?
No. I think I can get the U.S. reaction you want.
And he told us his plan. 77. On one side of the hut, I watched Jennifer and Shoshana planning their part of the mission, Shoshana tracing a route on a computer screen. On the other side, Johann was talking with the rest of the team, discussing the second stage of the plan. In the back sat Thomas and two of his friends, looking decidedly uneasy. I wondered if I should just tell all of them to stop, because I had a feeling Kurt was about to put the brakes on the entire operation. I decided we needed to do a little bit of detailed planning if we were going to try Johann's idea. So we turned Alexandra's little abandoned hut into a tactical operation center. A round building about 20 feet across with a thatched roof, it was a typical Basutu structure found all over the countryside. But now it resembled something out of an episode of Get Smart, an indigenous shack with four satellite antennae poking out of the straw on the roof. While the team dove into contingency planning, trying to predict second and third order effects, I had called Blaine, connecting with a VPN through my laptop so he could see my face. It was harder to tell a man no when you were looking at him in the eyes. Unfortunately, as soon as I'd connected, Blaine had told me to hold on, because Kurt was waiting on my contact. Which was odd. The only reason we had a commander for Omega Operations was precisely because operational decisions rested in his hands. Half the screen was blank, but the other half was Blaine's face, the background showing plywood. All he'd said was that Kurt wanted to speak to me, and to wait until he connected. Since it was closing in on 10 at night in D.C., I knew Kurt wasn't hanging around just to say hello. I said, come on, sir, give me a hint. He grimaced and said, your last plan raised some serious concerns in D.C. I'll let Kurt explain it. What? They were good with waiting on the coup to occur, but the minute I ask for help from the State Department, it becomes an issue? He said, pretty much. Trust me, this has caused a little questioning of my own ability to command. It's not coming from me. What does that mean? Before he could answer, the right half of the screen cleared, and I saw Kurt Hale. He said, everyone got me? I said, loud and clear. Blaine said, I copy, sir. I said, Blaine told you the state of play, right? Am I assuming your vaunted presence on this VTC is because you had some issues getting the Oversight Council to approve? Kurt spit out, Pike, I never took it to the Oversight Council. Not only that, but I'm close to firing Blaine for even considering such a completely insane plan. He was genuinely angry, taking me aback. He said, can you still execute what you briefed before, letting the coup happen and then scarfing up Colonel Armstrong? Or is this a shit show now? Confused at the venom, I said, sir, yes. I told Blaine that. We just need some support from State to make sure the new guy isn't assassinated in the first 10 minutes. What's the big deal? You didn't hear me. I mean, can you execute without your chosen replacement? What the hell? What difference does it make? Pike, you're conducting the literal Title 50 definition of covert action, which means you're breaking the law. He saw me scrunch up my eyes. Because saying the task force was breaking the law was like saying you would get wet if you went out in the rain. He continued, "You are way, way outside the bounds of our charter. I can't believe you even brought this up." His glance on the computer changed, and I knew he was looking at Blaine through his camera. He said, "And I cannot believe that the Omega Commander even considered this insanity. You get roped to run missions based on judgment, of which neither of you apparently own." I said, "Wait a minute, sir, what's the big deal? Watching the coup is okay, but helping with a good outcome is not?" "Precisely! Precisely! The task force exists within a charter, and I tested the bounds of that charter to give you a chance to get Aaron. I'm glad you got him, but now you've completely left the reservation. You're going to overthrow an entire country?" "Wait, sir. You knew that was going to happen. I knew you were going to watch sitting on the sidelines. Now you're working the coup. What's the difference? Pike? The law allowing covert action was specifically written to require a congressional finding before executing any activity that would affect the political, economic, or military conditions abroad, period. We fall outside of the title because capturing and killing terrorists doesn't do that. Our charter was specifically built around the prescriptions in Title 50. For a reason. Now you're running Operation Ajax and want me to sell that to the National Command Authority?" Operation Ajax was the code name for the coup the United States conducted in Iran in 1953, when we overthrew Prime Minister Mossadegh and installed the Shah. That action had led to another overthrow in 1979, and a hostage situation culminating in a disastrous failed rescue mission, executed by a unit we'd both once served in. He was making a point. I said, "Sir, we didn't plan or execute this thing. We're just helping to ensure a good outcome. What's the fucking difference? I don't get it. Pike, you sitting back and letting the coup happen is like a war photographer just documenting the battle. I can get away with that, because the mission, our mission, happens after the fact. We had no play in the coup. Now you're putting down the camera and picking up a rifle. May sound like splitting hairs with you, but it's a major, major problem." I leaned back, making sure nobody else could hear what was being discussed, relieved to see they were all engrossed in planning. I said, "Sir, the coup was almost complete, and we had nothing to do with it. All that matters is the outcome now." "Fine. That's what I like to hear. Conduct our mission and get out." I glanced at Thomas, seeing him fearfully talking to his friends, the precariousness of his position starkly evident by the trembling in his hands. I knew he would now be dead regardless of his participation. The new Prime Minister, Lanatha, would see him as a threat and he would disappear, just like he had before, only this time permanently. So, no help from the mighty United States. Just let this play out. Pike, get on the airfield and get me Colonel Armstrong. I've already leaned way out on this. Accomplish our mission. The truth of the matter was, I could execute Johann's plan without even reading Kurt onto it. The question was whether I was willing to. I thought about it, putting myself in Kurt's shoes, or more appropriately, putting him in mine. Would he do what I wanted to do if the roles were reversed? It didn't take a lot of reflection to come to an answer. I glanced at the crew, making sure they were still engaged. Johann had told us that not only had he planned the targets to neutralize, but he'd also planned no-fire areas, because the last thing he wanted was a foreign embassy to react on threats against its citizens. First on the list was the U.S. Embassy itself, but farther down was a children's hospital in the city. Johann was afraid that if it were threatened, the United States would react, sending troops to protect it, thereby interfering with the coup. His solution to my dilemma for U.S. involvement had been simple. Threaten the hospital, or at least tell the embassy it was under threat, and get them to react. Get them on the street. As far as I knew, it wasn't under duress, but it might be, and that might be enough to get the reaction I needed of American boots on the ground. Here we go. I said, "Sir, I'll get to the airfield and accomplish the mission. But there's something else you should be aware of. The coup's gone a little bit out of control. and American citizens are in danger. Do you want me to ignore them? What are you talking about? There's a children's hospital over here, in the city of Maseru. It's the Baylor College of Medicine, and it's caught in the crossfire.
Baylor? As in Baylor University?
I don't know. All I know is that it's full of AMSITs, and it's under fire. Kurt said, "How do you know this?" It's uncorroborated reporting. I don't know for sure, but I felt I should bring it up, even though it's not in our charter. He ignored that last comment, saying, "Can you do anything about it, with the force you have?" "Not really, beyond a reconnaissance. I can't secure it, but there's a Special Forces Security Assessment Team on the ground here, at the embassy. We could get them rolling, but it'll require release by the RSO at the embassy." Another Johann nugget. Apparently, he'd been interrogated by some paranoid members of General Masebo's staff while he was conducting a reconnaissance for the coup. And in their amateurish questioning, they'd let it slip that they thought he was a member of U.S. Special Forces that were on the ground right now.
"How do you know about the team?"
"Found out from Masebo's boys while we were rescuing Aaron. They thought we were them." He seemed to buy it. I said, "We're probably looking at a Neo here, regardless of the outcome with Armstrong and Malloy. You might want to start that ball rolling." Neo stood for Non-Combatant Evacuation Operation, a template most U.S. military forces on alert had on their plate. It was usually conducted when a situation in a foreign country went south and American citizens had to be rescued, like when there's a coup. Kurt said,
"I can make that happen, but it'll be a while before any forces can get on the ground. You get me information on the hospital without affecting your mission."
"Yeah, I can probably do that, but I can't interface with the embassy without compromising my mission. That'll have to happen from your end." Which was an absolute lie. I had every intention of lighting a fire under the embassy's ass. What I wanted was U.S. forces on the ground, waving the flag and providing a visible presence. And in order to do that, I needed to make the coup look like Dodge City. He said,
"Okay, see what you can find out about the hospital. Location, threats, evacuation routes, all the usual stuff. I'll pass that along to the embassy and try to break that SF team free to secure it until follow-on forces can get there."
"Will do."
He leaned back and said, "Okay, how much longer do I need to bite my nails? What's the rest of the plan?"
"It's pretty simple, sir. No real drama at this point. We head to the airport. The aircraft lands with the new prime minister. He takes over the country, and we take Colonel Armstrong into custody. Armstrong is supposed to stay on the ground after the mercenary force flies out. So we let them leave, capture Armstrong, then fly out on the L-100. I stopped and addressed Blaine. "Sir, that's still good to go, right?"
"Yes. It's waiting on your call in Johannesburg. 30-minute flight."
I returned to Kurt and said, "We ring out Armstrong and set up Tyler Malloy. We get Malloy and the triggers, and Lesotho gets a new government.
What's your timeline?"
I was a little miffed at the lack of concern for Lesotho.
"Sir, what's the difference between putting in Thomas instead of Lenatha? Can't we do that?" "Pike, we aren't going to have anything to do with this coup. If they want to do that, it's up to them."
Which was good enough for me. I said, "Roger all, sir. The timeline is within the next 2 hours. We're going to roll with your final approval." He nodded and said,
"You've got it. Keep us posted and get me some information on the hospital. The last thing I want to hear is that there are dead Americans, because we let a coup go forward. I need to wake a few people up if I'm going to get that SF team rolling."
I said, "Yes, sir," but was thinking, that SF team will be at the hospital long before you get through the Pentagon phone book.
78. Shoshana tracked the route on her computer and said, "Next intersection, take a left. You'll see the river and a golf course. Parallel it and follow the signs for the Maseru Bridge crossing into South Africa. You'll run right up to the front gate." Jennifer said, "Okay, time to win an Oscar. How are you doing back there, Alex?" From the back seat, Alex said,
I don't think I'm going to have to do any acting.
Hang in there. The embassy will have a doctor on staff and a medical clinic. You're almost home free. Jennifer saw the golf course on the left of her SUV, and Shoshana said, 500 meters. The golf course peeled away, and she saw a cutout with metal barriers, then the United States flag. Shoshana said, that's it, that's it. Jennifer whipped into the turnout, and two U.S. Marines in full combat gear, complete with M16A2s, came barreling out from behind a barricade, holding their hands up in the universal sign to stop. Jennifer did, and the first Marine trained his weapon on her while the second came to her window. Acting hysterical, she rolled it down and shouted, "There's fighting going on! They're shooting people! They shot my friend!" The Marine said, "Whoa, wait a minute, calm down. Who are you?" "I'm Jennifer Cahill. I'm a U.S. citizen. We work at the Baylor Children's Hospital downtown. They're shooting all around it, and my friends are still there. You need to help us." He looked at her passport, with Jennifer holding her breath that he didn't inspect it closely enough to realize she had no work visa for Lesotho. He did not. He turned and shouted to the gate, "Metz, Blashford, get out here and give me a hand." 20 minutes later, they were inside the embassy compound, with Jennifer spilling her tall tale about hostiles threatening U.S. citizens. A man in business casual attire appeared, looking like he was going to attend an embassy briefing, except he was wearing a Kevlar helmet and had a pistol on his hip. He said, "My name is Ian Tesler. I'm the regional security officer here. What's going on?" Jennifer was surprised. She figured it would take 10 minutes of screaming to get him to appear. She had to feign ignorance of embassy operations, but the RSO, the man from the Diplomatic Security Service, charged specifically with the safety and security of citizens overseas, was the one person who could create the visible presence Pike needed. She repeated her story, ending with, "You have to get some Marines over there right now and protect the people at the hospital." She knew there was no way Ian would release the Marines, as their specific mission was protecting the U.S. Embassy from harm or takeover. But it was her first step. Ian said, "That's not the reporting we're getting. The fighting is localized to specific areas. Very surgical. In fact, it looks like it might just be a gang war, or something like that." Jennifer pointed to Alexandra, now on a stretcher and being treated with an IV. "Does that look localized? She's shot, for God's sake." Ian held up his hands and said, "Okay, okay, please calm down. I know the hospital you're talking about. It's not near any shooting that we're tracking. We've sent out a warden message for people to remain in their homes, and we've had no calls from the hospital." Jennifer faked being incensed. "Maybe their phones are out. Did you think of that?" Ian said, "Look, I don't have the forces to secure a hospital. All I can do is ensure the word gets out. My advice is simply to hunker down and let this pass." She pointed at the Marine to her left and said, "What is that?" "That man is dedicated to the U.S. Embassy." "So you get protected while my friends die? Why the hell am I paying taxes?" Ian said, "Ma'am, those Marines have a mission. There's only so much we can plan for. If..." Another man entered their circle, cutting his speech short. He was dressed in civilian clothes but draped in military kit, and Jennifer knew he was who she'd been looking for. Take away the body armor and weapons, and he dressed just like Pike. A shirt with 1,000 pockets, and pants made to carry magazines of ammo. The clincher was his beard, a lumberjack thing that Pike would have made fun of. He might as well have put on a nameplate that read, "Operator, dammit." The man said, "Ian, you need us to do anything? Can I tell the boys to stand down or what?" Looking aggravated, Ian said, "Yes, just keep them in the break room. Nothing has happened to require an armed response." Shoshana took one look at the man, then surreptitiously bumped Jennifer like she was trying to get her to introduce them for a date. Jennifer glared at her, letting her know she understood, and said, "Who are you?" The man glanced at Jennifer as an aside, not worthy of his consideration, then did a double take when he took in who was asking. He became polite, saying, "My name's Clint, Clint Carnegie. Was that your friend who was just evac'd?" Jennifer said, "Yes, it was, and she's not the last. We need some help. Americans are dying." Clint looked at the RSO, asking, "What's she talking about?" "Nothing that we can confirm. She just arrived." To Clint, Jennifer said, "We need help. They're in danger." He said, "Danger? How?" His head flicked between Jennifer and Ian, and she knew she'd just earned a seat at the table. Ian said, "No danger that we can see. The danger is driving around. If everyone stays put, they'll be fine." "Doesn't look like she's making it up." He turned to Jennifer and said, "What's going on?" Jennifer felt the first tendrils of shame, knowing she was lying. She said, "I don't know. All I know is that our hospital is in the line of fire of whatever's happening out there. We need some protection." Ian said, "Wait, wait. Your friend got shot on the way here, not at the hospital." "You can't say that. You don't know." Clint looked at Ian and said, "That girl was shot in a gunfight?" "Yes, yes, but not in a threatening sense." "Not in a threatening sense? What the fuck does that mean? Was she shot or not? I thought she was in a car wreck or something." Ian drew up and said, "She was, but just on the street on the way here. I've given the warden call. We can't save everyone." Jennifer said, "But you can save my friends at the hospital. You can do that." Three men dressed like Clint appeared, draped in kit and bristling with weapons. One said, "What's going on, boss?" He said, "I don't know." Ian said, "You cannot leave here without my authorization. You're working here under my command." Jennifer pulled the pin on her verbal grenade, hoping it was enough. She dropped it at their feet. "This is just like Benghazi. You guys are going to sit here protecting yourself while my friends die." The words echoed in the courtyard, the men of the SF team looking at their commander. She felt Shoshana pinch her, meaning that little devil had read the reaction of the team, and Jennifer had won. Ian said, "Wait, wait, this isn't Libya, and you guys aren't going anywhere." Clint said, "It isn't Libya yet, and I don't fucking work for you. I work for SOCOM." Jennifer hid a grin. Shoshana bumped her with her hip again. Ian said, "Nobody leaves here. Nobody goes out into the street. You could make this so much worse if an American is killed. Let it play out. This isn't Benghazi." Jennifer knew he was absolutely correct, but also that his order would cause their plan to fail. She said, "Screw you guys. I'll do it myself. I'll be back with whoever I can save." She turned to the gate, and Ian said, "You're not going anywhere. You said it yourself. Being on the street is dangerous. I can't let you go." Jennifer gave Clint her most plaintive stare, and he said, "Fuck this, we're going." Ian said, "You will not go." Clint said, "That's the last thing that shithead in Benghazi said. I'm not going to sit here while Americans are slaughtered." He turned to leave, and the RSO stood in his way. "You do this, and I'll fucking fry your ass." Clint pushed him out of the way, shouting, "Timmons, load up the team!" Embarrassed for the RSO, Jennifer caught Clint's sleeve and said, "Our vehicle's outside. I'll lead you to the hospital." Clint nodded, and Jennifer glanced at Shoshana. Shoshana raised her eyebrows and whispered, "What are we going to do when there's no threat at the hospital?" Jennifer followed the team, all shifting weapons and positioning kit like they were about to assault the Islamic State in Mosul. She said, I don't know, sexual favors? The comment actually made Shoshana chuckle. I don't think Aaron would agree with that. They loaded their SUV, waiting on the team vehicles to appear through the gate. Jennifer said, neither would Pike, but it would serve him right for making up this stupid plan.
79. I said, so, you're rolling now?
Yeah, we're probably 10 minutes out, but I don't know what I'm going to say to the team leader when we get there, and they tell him, one, that they're perfectly safe, and two, that they have no idea who we are.
We just left there. It'll be okay. It is full of foreigners, with a lot of Americans, and they're all scared shitless. You can hear the gunfire from the front gate, and they know something's going down. I talked to the head nurse and she begged for help, petrified that Lesotho is going to turn into Rwanda and they're all going to get their arms chopped off. I told her help was on the way.
So she's expecting us?
Yeah. She'll play ball. I told her I was headed to the embassy to get someone to help. So when you show up, just play stupid. In the meantime, I told her to call all of her American friends and have them consolidate at the hospital. It's about to become the collection point for U.S. citizens. That'll force the embassy to leave the team in place. Kurt's working a NEO option. So, with any luck, we'll have more American soldiers wandering around than Lesotho citizens. It'll keep anybody who's thinking about a counter-coup from appearing anytime soon.
Sounds good to me. What do you want me to do once I've dropped these guys off?
Go back to Thomas and wait for our call. We'll meet up at the airport. We'd left Thomas and his entourage at the abandoned hooch, telling him we'd come for him when necessary. I didn't like leaving him alone, fearing he'd get cold feet, but I wasn't going to leave a gunfighter behind just to babysit.
Got it, we'll do.
Coco, one thing. Stay off the main arteries. We just came through them, and Johan was a little premature on the consolidation phase. There is a running gun battle going on at the Prime Minister's residence. Apparently that fight has drawn the police force. They have no orders from higher, because the coup decapitated the leadership of the police. But someone at the residence got a call out to them. It's turning into a pitched battle. You finish with the hospital, and you take the back roads, you hear?
I thought Johan said the Prime Minister was dead.
Yeah, but apparently that news hasn't received wide dissemination. Johan's guys are pinned down. He's trying to extract them. Because at the end of the day, the damn firefight is over nothing. But it hasn't happened yet. Just stay clear of the main roads. Jennifer said,
Okay, we'll do that. We'll be fine. What about you?
We're headed to the police headquarters right now, and people are starting to loot and pillage like a Rodney King riot. Johan's got the rest of the teams breaking down and headed to the airport, as planned. The Lesotho Special Forces guys will stay to secure the targets. I guess waiting on General Masebo to show up.
So where does that leave us?
I'll let you know in 20 minutes. We're either going to be heroes or zeros. Kurt had gone batshit over the prohibitions for covert action in Title 50 of the U.S. Code. But now, I was really doing it. The title read, an activity or activities of the United States government to influence political, economic, or military conditions abroad, where it is intended that the role of the United States government will not be apparent or acknowledged. Change out United States government for task force, and that was exactly what I was doing. I was attempting to alter the political conditions abroad right under the noses of my masters, hoping my actions wouldn't be apparent. If I succeeded, I'd be a hero, and nobody would even realize it had happened. If I failed, the entire mission would fail. Because there was no way I would capture Colonel Armstrong if this blew up in my face. But I honestly felt Thomas was worth it. Aaron had been right about him. Thomas had seen how the other half lived, and had realized that Lesotho had been living in a world of poverty it didn't deserve. Unfailingly friendly, willing to give the very clothes off their backs, the Lesotho people had been scraping by hand to mouth for more than a century. In the past, it had been just the way of things, as all tribes in Africa were no better off. But it had remained the same even after the exploitation of Lesotho's water and the discovery of diamonds, the government content to sell its people's birthright to corporate interests. Thomas could put a stop to that, but only if we were successful. What made it worse was that I was doing the mission in the shadow of my own team. They thought Kurt was on board.